You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Hello, this is Karin Zissas of ASCOA Online. As we've been discussing in some of our recent podcasts, 2018 is a big year for Latin American elections, with the three biggest countries, Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, all choosing new leaders. But first up is Costa Rica, where voters will cast ballots on Sunday, February 4th. At this point, the race can't be called for any one candidate, and we talked with pollsters in San Jose about why. Before we get to that, I spoke with my colleague, Holly Sunderland, who previously reported for the Tico Times. She set the stage for what's happening with Costa Rica's vote. Hi, Holly.
Hello.
Costa Rica is the first one to be holding a presidential vote this year. It's taking place on Sunday, right, Holly?
Yes. So Costa Rica will have presidential and legislative general elections on Sunday, February 4th. And traditionally, for the first 50 years of their modern democracy, they never needed a second round. The bar for the first round, you only need 40% of the vote to win. And that was what happened. And then in 2002, they had their first runoff ever. And then they had another one in 2014. And this year, everybody expects there to be a second round. So the second round will take place on April 1st, which happens to be Easter Sunday this year. So there are just a whole bunch of curveballs coming into everything, even down to the dates.
One of the things that I want to talk about is that Costa Rica does have something in common with some of the other countries holding elections this year, and that is that corruption has been a big issue or sort of a backdrop to the election. Can you talk a little bit about what the situation is in Costa Rica in terms of corruption as an issue? What's the situation there? And what other kinds of issues are emerging as top election issues ahead of Sunday?
So the huge scandal that dominated the campaign news in 2017 was called the Cementazo. It's like basically the big cement story. And it started with just about a businessman who discovered these loopholes where he could basically import cement from China for free. But it has just become this kind of sinkhole politically. It has involved President Luis Guillermo Solís has been tied personally to it, and so his party has been also. Several congressmen, including one current candidate, the Libertarian candidate, are under investigation right now. So this has been the executive branch, the legislative, and critically for Costa Rica, there is a Supreme Court judge who has been suspended because of his involvement. He had very close ties, it turns out, to this businessman. They sent something like over 600 texts and calls in a 16-month period, Costa Rican police have found. So that dominated headlines last year and really ensnared almost every single major candidate. And so it made it a very hard issue for candidates to run on, too, because they couldn't say they wanted to be the anti-corruption candidate because they were tied to it themselves. So, but then that has also, in the recent polls, corruption has actually taken a back seat to some other issues. But the two big headlines, social issues, have come to a forefront in this last month before the election, because on January 9th, so this is less than a month before the vote, the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, which is a regional court but based in San Jose, they issued a ruling saying that all countries who are signatories or who are members of the court needed to recognize gay marriage and many other LGBT rights, including transgender rights and things like that. And so that has, and there's very strong opposition to gay marriage in Costa Rica, or I should say it's about two-thirds of Costa Ricans are opposed to gay marriage and to the court's ruling. And so that has really spurred the this kind of social conservative movement in these last few weeks before the February 4th vote.
I find that really interesting because I think to outsiders, Costa Rica is always seen as a very progressive country. You know, people think of environmentalism and education as really strong points for the country. So it's interesting to hear that there's this socially conservative movement. happening. How are you seeing that reshaping the election? Can you talk about who some of the candidates are, how it's affecting the polls, and voters' views of the candidates?
So the interesting thing, and we'll hear this later in the podcast, but the pollsters actually have found this level kind of opposition to gay marriage is pretty constant, or it has been consistent for a while now. There's still a relatively high level of Catholicism in Costa Rica. It's the only country in the Americas with an official state religion, and that is Roman Catholicism. And still in surveys, voters affirm that they want that. There's a small movement to try and have that change so that Costa Rica could be a secular state. But a majority of Costa Ricans still say they want there to be a state religion. And so not only is the Catholic Church very strong, but there's also been other Protestant groups and evangelical and Pentecostal groups, which you see in kind of other parts of Central America, that also have pretty significant presences in Costa Rica. So in this election, it's not as if sort of more people have become more religious through this election. It's just that Costa Rica for so long was just a bipartisan system. It was very straight down, you know, to politics, and people had a lot of pride in their national parties. And basically all of that has kind of come undone. You don't see the parades where people are wearing, you know, their colors or the party out in the street. So there's a lot less enthusiasm for the party, for the parties. And then in general, these social issues have kind of really taken a hold of the anxiety and the indecision that Tico voters feel. Una familia unida, segura por la vida, donde nuestros sueños se hagan realidad. And it's kind of made this perfect storm. And so certain candidates are particularly taking advantage of that. Most notably is a candidate whose name is Fabricio Alvarado. He's currently a congressman. He also is a contemporary Christian singer, which is just a funny oddity. Don't find that much with other candidates. Hoy estoy sentado frente a mi rey. Él me oirá. So from December to January, he was polling at 3% in December. He jumped to 17% in not only the SEEP poll, which are the pollsters we'll talk to later, but in several other polls in Costa Rica in January. So a jump that's kind of borne out. Now we'll see if that still holds, you know, in the days before the election, but he by far has been benefiting from this social the surge kind of social issues. But you're also seeing other more establishment candidates try and pivot to take advantage of this sort of social interest in social issues. At top of that list would be Antonio Alvarez de Santi. He's the candidate for the National Liberation Parties, which is one of Costa Rica's most established parties. Crecimos bajo tu sombra, mi querida Costa Rica. Cuando la fe, la esperanza y la vida sonreían, era sin mí. He, in earlier months when he was campaigning, said that he thinks that he thought that Costa Rica should let the courts decide on gay marriage. He's basically fully pivoted to the conservative part of saying that he said that the court made this decision behind Costa Rica's back. The other big social issue that he's also now come out against is a plan by the education ministry to teach gender ideology in schools. For something as seemingly unrelated as an education ministry proposal is actually having a big hand in these elections. And you're seeing candidates very explicitly come out against this gender ideology thing. There was a rally in San Jose against it, and I think four of the main candidates attended. And let's see, other candidates... Rodolfo Pisa Rocafort was also there. He is another more traditional candidate. He ran in the last election. And so Pisa was also at the rally as well. And then the one other candidate, which is kind of crazy, we haven't mentioned him yet, is Juan Diego Castro. And he is... Some have been calling him, you know, he's the Trump of the tropics in this Costa Rica race. So, necesita a Juan Diego Castro, un presidente de verdad. He made a lot of headlines, and he's led some polls recently, but the polling has been pretty all over the place. But he is certainly a contender to make it into the second round. He's a pretty well-known lawyer. He's done obviously legal work, and he's a professor, but he also has he's very fond of the media, especially television. He makes regular television appearances, but he's very fond of criticizing the media. He blocks tons of journalists on Twitter. He said in January that he was going to shutter the La Nación, which is Costa Rica's biggest daily, within his first year of office. But we've actually, interestingly, his rise seemed to be pretty steady in the last part of 2017. But it actually seems in January he might have faltered a bit because of just some of the outrageous claims that he's made. I mean, he made the suggestion that justices on the Supreme Court only made it there by giving out sexual favors. So it's just, and I think some of those statements are actually coming back. Again, I think they've actually tempered his rise in the polls a little bit, but he's still definitely up there. I mean, again, according to the polls, as many as six candidates are legit contenders for the second round. And of course, everybody has in their mind 2014 when, out of seemingly nowhere, Luis Guillermo Solís went from 11-12% in the polls to then winning the first round vote with almost 31%. So I think everybody is very wary that a similar upset could happen this year and is maybe even more likely because there's so much more volatility.
So even though you're talking about a certain candidate having 17% of the vote or something like that, it's really hard. It's something like it's just really hard to predict who's going to make it to that second round.
Yes, because even candidates who have been able to register double-digit support, by far the leading contender right now in the polls is people are undecided. It's still about 30% of TICO voters are undecided. And not only that, we're going to hear about this a little more in the podcast, but people are changing their votes, their decisions for who they're going to vote for much more often. And then there's much less enthusiasm so for this. And then especially with big hurdles, the second round is sort of a new thing. This whole strategy of how you vote in the first round versus the second round, that's a new scenario for a lot of TICO voters. The fact that the second round is going to be held on Easter just, again, adds a whole bunch more uncertainty.
So who are we going to be hearing from today? Can you tell us who you spoke to in Costa Rica and what are some of the topics listeners can expect to hear about in this podcast?
So I spoke with the doctors Felipe Altizar and Ronald Alfaro. They are from the University of Costa Rica's Center for Research and Political Studies. And so they ran me through basically just how deep the uncertainty and kind of the volatility right now in this election goes and where they are seeing that and in ways that are new. They also talked about some of the other studies they're doing alongside these monthly polling. They're doing some longitudinal studies. They've also been expanding their methodology, especially since the 2014 election. So now we went over a whole range of stuff.
Great. Well, I look forward to hearing more.
Thanks so much. Felipe and Ronald, thank you so much for being with us here today. So you guys are pollsters at the University of Costa Rica's Center for Research and Political Studies. You just released a survey 2 weeks ahead of Costa Rica's general elections, and the huge finding in this January survey was that one candidate in particular, Fabricio Alvarado, rose 14 points from the December survey. He went from 3% to 17% of voter intention. What was your reaction when you saw those numbers?
Well, there are several issues that we need to discuss related to this to this change in January. The first thing to talk about is that this election has been a very unusual election for many reasons. One of the most important reasons why we consider this a very unusual situation is that there are a lot of people that we have been conducting polls since October, and the number of people undecided in this election is bigger, significantly bigger, than in previous election, including the 2014 last presidential election. And the other reason why we talk about in terms of unusual conditions is that there are people changing their minds like very often. From one week to another, from one month to another month, they choose a candidate and then they say, well, this is not my candidate anymore. I want another one and I'm not convinced And there are people moving in this direction from one candidate to another. That these kind of movements changes the volatility in this election is so big that makes the situation very unpredictable.
That's very interesting. So then, who then are some of the people who shifted their support to Alvarado? What is a typical Fabricio Alvarado supporter?
Well, there is one thing that you have to add to Ronald's answer, is that the traditional reasons for voting, for example, the party alignments, are not working anymore. So people are not voting or deciding for any political party, and more for the person, for the leader. And in January, we had this resolution from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that said that that many rights for the people from the LGBT community, gay marriage, and some other related with the identity, that Costa Rica would needed to allow these rights. So that produced a huge reaction on the conservative side. And probably Fabricio Alvarado concentrated the support, because he said that Costa Rica, in his eventual government, that Costa Rica would drop off of the court. So people who were against this resolution immediately shift their support to Fabricio Alvarado. It's a conservative reaction to this resolution of the court.
Yes, and also this court ruling you're talking about from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights came on January 9th. This survey that you did, I saw the dates you conducted between January 15th and 17th, so relatively very shortly after this. And then I also noticed in this most recent survey, about two-thirds of Costa Ricans both said that they do not support gay marriage and that they are against this court ruling. Were those levels higher than you've seen in previous surveys, or are they about consistent with where TICO support for gay marriage has been over the years?
Well, the numbers that we saw in this last survey are consistent, very consistent, with the numbers that we have been seeing, since many years ago. Perhaps the resolution obviously increments this kind of reaction among people and creates the conditions for the effects of this shock in the electorate. But it's part of our political culture. Costa Rica is a conservative country, has been a conservative place. It's not only because of the resolution, but it's pretty much the same. We have the numbers are a little bit higher, but not so different than the numbers that we published like a year ago in the same topics.
And religion is very important for the people. In this survey that Donald is telling you, and it was a year ago, we asked the people how important was religion in their lives. And 70% of the people said that religion was very important. So the country is divided. It changes a little bit in relation with the topics, but it's divided in 30 to 70% or 40 to 60, but it's almost the same relation than two-thirds and one-third.
And when you break down the demographics of that support, are there certain demographic groups who are more likely to oppose gay rights or more likely to support them? Where do you see opposition and support the highest?
Women, people who are older, also people who are less educated, is more in favor of opposing these kind of rights. But also, well, obviously, in terms of who are in favor, we are talking about younger people, more male, and also people who are more educated, people who live in the central valley, more urban. Those are basic demographics about in favor, people who are in favor and against this kind of political or cultural.
As much as there has been consistency, and then we've seen some differences in the volatility of people's allegiances, are there any other things that are notable, places you see the Costa Rican electorate is changing or moving, or do you see it more staying the same course?
Well, the most important change in terms of the electorate in Costa Rica is not, it's not a change that is, it's not a short period change. But we as what we are seeing in our polls and in other studies also is that there has been a long-term kind of force or factor impacting the voters' behavior. And that change is related to the erosion or the erosion of the political identity, party ID identification in terms of the US terms. The most important change, again, is that people are losing their identification, this kind of attachment to the parties. And that change is so relevant in terms of political mobilization, turnout, for instance. Political parties and voters' identification with the parties is the most important, is the driver of turnout. And the reason why people are like asking which candidate to support, they don't have a definitive idea or a clear, like clear-cut kind of idea or crystal clear idea about which candidate to support. And they are like asking, well, what should I do? Which candidate is better? Which candidate do you think? Tell me. They ask their friends or relatives, tell me which candidate to support. I need information. And they are like in this kind of context, they are like disoriented, right? They are like looking for information, and it's very difficult. What we realize in these polls is that it has been very difficult for them to make that decision, to take that decision.
And then, so just to give people some context, for the latter part of the 20th century, Costa Rican politics was bipartisan system. You had the PLN and the PUSC were your two parties. And roughly from what you guys have seen over the years, about how many people identified with those two parties, and then where do those parties, where is their support in the mix-up? Like, are we talking about, 9 out of 10 Ticos were for one of the two parties now, and today it's only 5 out of 10? Or how much have those two parties lost of the share of voter support?
Now it's like 2 of 10 people, of 10 Ticos that support these parties. It can change in the period of the election, but in the like the core of the party, it's I would say 25%. So it's like an anxious vote, if you think, because people are looking for a reason to vote, because they don't have the historical reason, these party identities, and people are looking for a reason. So when you have this populism or these conservative reasons, I mean, obviously the problem of security in Costa Rica is very important, as in the rest of Central America. So people are looking for security. There comes a candidate that says, I'm going to fix security. I will have a mano dura, the strong hand that has been in effect in Central America and other places and hasn't worked. But this candidate has promised people the mano dura, a hard response to insecurity. And then you have this other issue that is the conservative and the religion factor. So people are like looking for these two big issues that are very common in their lives, very day-to-day life. So the question is if at the end, if the people will vote for these reasons or other problems in the country will also get into the arena. For example, we have problems with employment, the fiscal issue and infrastructure. There are other issues, but it hasn't been so strong in the campaign as these two others that I told.
I wanted to ask about that too, because in this January survey, it was unemployment and security were the top two problems. But as of October, corruption was actually the number two problem. But then that had fallen in this most recent survey. What did you take, from that? Or
one of the features that define this election is that there is no narrative about this election, right? In the 2014 election, it was clear that the narrative was about change, and candidates were fighting, among them, fighting for becoming the change figure, right? The political figure that embodies the kind of change that people were looking for. But in 2018, we started the campaign, no narrative at all. Candidates were like looking for also they were looking for issues in order to take control of the campaign, right? But we started in October and in November again. Corruption seems to be playing that role, but was not as strong in December, but also now in January. And did this situation confirms that this election has been an election without this kind of narrative that define or shapes the candidates' agenda and campaigns and their message, right? Instead of that, they are also candidates are in a very difficult situation, trying to again to find which is the most important topic or narrative that drives or attracts voters to their campaign.
And you have to add that in October that the topic was corruption. Corruption was actually affecting all of them. So it wasn't useful for them that the narrative of the campaign was corruption, because all the parties were affected in their support levels in relation with corruption, because the case that was coming out was related with a crisis with a company that imported concrete, the cemento. It was affecting all the parties. So it wasn't a good idea for them to start a campaign with this narrative. So they have react to different issues. As I said, the security, now this conservative, but it's not them who control the narrative, but I mean, the facts or different issues like this court resolution that are popping up, and they're just reacting to that.
Yeah, I noticed there was one line too in the report that said, more voters said they had a lot of interest in the election, but that the level of enthusiasm had stayed the same. So they were paying attention, but still not as motivated to pick a candidate.
Usually in the campaigns, the expectation is that people start, the very first of the campaign, the first weeks, they start very low levels of enthusiasm, motivation, interest, right? As the campaign goes on, we usually expect to see slow increments, but again, increments in terms of these issues. But in our report, in our reports, the situation is a little bit different, because we start in October, very low levels. In November, we identify a small change an increment in that. But in December, we go back to the points that we discussed in October. So it's not, this campaign has not motivated or attract people in the same way that in previous election. It's it seems to be people are looking or people are in a kind of shock, because they are not used to the situation in which they have no clear shortcuts in terms of the decision, right? The decision making right now for voters is so complicated that people are very frustrated with this circumstance. And that makes the campaign, again, very unusual, right? We are gonna see, in January now, seems that the situation is changing a little bit. People are talking more, people are in shock in terms of some of these results, and still they are still in the process of decision making. In terms of support, the results that we published this week are not necessarily the last swing of the election. We are sure that these results are not the last play of the game.
Usually the campaigns in Costa Rica were very passionate. People were very were decided for adoption, and they support this option in the streets with flags and very passionate. This campaign is more, the word will be like an anxious campaign. People have anxiety because they don't know how to vote and they're looking for an answer. And also it's a campaign that, fear has a lot of weight in this campaign because people fear that they are going to lose their traditional values or what is going to happen with the country in terms of security. So as you probably know, when people have fear, they are used, normally they tend to go to the safer option. So, it's not an ordinary campaign because it is not a passionate campaign, but a campaign full of anxiety. I just thought that the answer is blowing in the wind. Voters are like moving around. Just if the wind comes this way, they move this way, and if the other way, it's like the answer is blowing in the wind.
Mm-hmm. And we know that the concerns with corruption are tied to the Cementazo scandal. The social issues are tied to the recent court ruling. What is fueling the concerns about security?
Obviously, security becomes one of the most important also issues now because of the homicides rate. Yeah. But it seems that people are not driving by that reason. So people are not, because of the campaign, again, in the absence or in this situation that no narrative in the campaign, the candidates have had a hard time like define or trying to figure it out which are the topics to attract voters. They are not proactive in terms of taking the control of the agenda, but instead of that, they are like reacting to shocks, external shocks. One of those, the most recent one, is the resolution of the court, and that reshaped the campaign, right?
And I know one other factor too, and that would make it more difficult for voters to be able to pick their choice, is that these February 4th elections are just the general elections, and they're the first round of a presidential vote, and that if no candidate gets over 40%, then it'll go to a runoff between the top two candidates. And not only then does that make the strategy trying to pick your first or second choice more difficult, but also the runoff itself is a relatively more recent occurrence. I don't think any election in the 20th century made it to a second round. So I was wondering, have you guys done any polling on some of the head-to-head competitions, how these candidates might do against each other in a potential runoff?
Not yet. We are still waiting for timing, the best time to do that. And the decision why we haven't done it yet is because this election is so unpredictable. Right now, there are like five or even six candidates that can make to the runoff, depending upon circumstances, the changes that in these last days of the election. That's why we haven't done it, the scenarios yet. There are multiple scenarios right now. Even the TV channels, they are organizing the debates, the final debates in the very last few days, and they are still figuring out which candidate to invite, because this situation is so fluid and the volatility is so high that they are asking pollsters, what is the situation, what's going on, and do you think that this situation is the final one? And we said, well, wait, right? Because this context is changing a lot, and it's changing rapidly, and it's changing in direction that people are not accustomed to that. It's like this campaign is a roller coaster. It's a roller coaster campaign.
And it changes day by day. There are six candidates that are on top, and any of them could fall or go up in their support. So it's day by day.
Our project is more like an academic-based project. And we were sure that this situation was coming, because and that's why we, as a poster at the University of Costa Rica, we decided to conduct different studies at the same time. We have also a longitudinal study, a panel of voters, and we are tracking them every month. We did it in October, November, and December. And this last weekend, we are going to start asking them again, what is this? What do you think? Are you supporting some candidate? Have you changed your mind? And in what direction? And what we are seeing in this longitudinal study is that there are, just let me give you these numbers, 4 out of 10 voters in our panel, almost 2,000 people, we asked them, which candidate do you support? And 4 out of the decided voters, those who support one candidate, in 1 month, they change their mind. 4 out of 10. We're not talking about the undecided ones. These are people who said, I have a preference. And they change their mind very rapidly in different directions. They are moving from one candidate to another. They go back to decided to undecided side. And this situation is so fluid.
And new, too.
And new, too. In one of these posts, in one of the posts, I guess now in December, we asked people, who do you think are going to be the two candidates in the runoff, in case we have one? And people were choosing many different options. It's not, they are not thinking only in terms of two or four. No, they are thinking in terms of six. And this is great.
And I think probably one thing that's making everybody be more cautious this year in 2018 is that in 2014, there was a very unexpected result. Luis Guillermo Solis was polling in fourth at about 11 or 12%. In just up to the week before the first round vote, which he won with over 30%. What did you guys learn from that year, from the polling to the results?
In 2014, we saw like the beginning of this roller coaster because it was fluid. It was a different campaign as the historical ones, but every of the phenomenon we are seeing now was like smaller in that election. But as Ronald said, the main narrative, the main issue was change. So it was this topic that like concentrated all the discussion. In our case, it's not only one issue. In 2018, so we learned that we have to be prepared for this volatility, that we needed to take different measures, different kind of surveys and studies to try to understand this changing dynamics. And well, that's the reason that we try to be as prepared as you can be.
Did you change any of your methodology from the last time around?
Yeah, exactly. In 2014, we conduct a small panel, very few people. And even with that sample, that was around 200 people, we were able to see the evolution of these, the preferences, the changes, and the particularly the direction. And based on that, at the beginning of this campaign, we decided to conduct the panel in a bigger sample, the one that is really solid and very more credible, and also more sophistication. We tried to put more sophistication in terms of the questions that we asked them. And at the beginning of the panel in October, we asked many questions to them. It was a very long survey, in order to build a profile, a political profile of the voters at the very beginning of the campaign. We are going to check if that profile, that political profile, is similar at the end of the campaign or not. Were there some changes in that? So these are the main questions. The main our interest is now based on how are people making this decision in this very unusual conditions. This is the most important question that we ask in this panel. Obviously, the preference of the candidates and the race, presidential race, is relevant, but for us it's more important to understand, to better comprehend these what are the drivers and the factors shaping this situation. Right?
Well, that's all I have for today. Thank you both so much again for your time, and we'll see what happens on February 4th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. For more about Costa Rica's election, check the podcast description for a link to an in-depth explainer. If you want to hear more about what's in store for this big year of regional votes, go to www.as-coa.org/2018. This ASCOA podcast was produced by Luisa Lemmy. I'm your host, Karin Zissis, Editor-in-Chief of ASCOA Online. The music you heard in this episode was performed by the Cliff Corman Ensemble during an America Society concert at Le Poisson Rouge in New York City. Find out about upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If so, please be sure to leave us a review, share, and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud.